Einstein is a name synonymous with intelligence, and not just intelligence, but really genius-level intelligence. We say Albert Einstein is a genius for many reasons, and surely one of those reasons was his willingness to ask penetrating what-if kinds of questions. It was one of those questions that led him to the theory of relativity when he asked what would happen if light and space were in a way that he could ride on a beam of light. Scientists say Einstein challenged the perimeters of reality by asking what-if questions, and not just about the forces of nature, but also about the human condition. A colleague said that Einstein challenged reality by imagining himself in someone else's shoes, in the same way that he imagined riding a beam of light. And it was that powerful imagination that enabled him to, quote, acquire an amazing, animating, ethical virtue of empathy. Hold that thought and add this one to it. It's by the 19th century Unitarian astronomer Maria Mitchell, who says, "We are tethered to all by the beautiful dependencies of law, so that not only the sparrow's fall is felt to the outermost bounds, but the vibrations set in motion by the words we utter reach through all space and the tremor felt through all time." It often takes genius-level creativity to challenge the parameters of reality when all is tethered by the dependencies of natural law. To both push the limits of reality and accept the limits of reality seems like a paradoxical proposition, and maybe it is, but it's a paradox that's familiar because it's one we live with every single day. We talked about this at a minister's meeting a while back when we were all asked to describe the ways in which we acknowledge seemingly paradoxical and opposite aspects of ourselves. It was a great exercise. We heard one person say how much he loves football and how he cries unabashedly in operas. Someone else said that each day he drives to his gym so that he can walk on the treadmill. One minister said that she tried hard to raise her daughters to be fiercely independent feminists, and now she keeps thinking how nice it would be if they got married and settled down and had babies. And then she said, "I can't believe I just said that out loud." I don't know. I hope hearing these examples won't mean that you think ministers don't have fully integrated personalities. I'm sure some of us do. But my guess is that most of us have at least some opposite personality traits of our own that seem just like the ones I just cited. It's not surprising to hear that Einstein asked what-if questions. After all, how would we come upon new discoveries if someone wasn't pushing the limits of reality? But what if we tried it this way? And anyone can do that. Any of us can ask questions like that. Imagine if we asked what our nation and even the world would be like if we insisted on having a Department of World Peace with the same budget and the same resources as the Department of Defense. What if we all agreed to make the sacrifices necessary to give up our dependence on oil, taking the steps to really protect the environment and the earth? And of course, the follow-up question to that is, and what if we don't? Questions like these work whether we ask them about the future or the past. There is a book called What If? By Robert Cowley, and he asks a number of historians to take a pivotal moment in history, a point, and imagine a different outcome. What if, asks one historian, Pontius Pilate had let Jesus go, and he'd not been crucified on the cross, but continued to minister for another 30 or 40 years, eventually dying of natural causes? What if that had happened? What if Winston Churchill had lost the election to Lord Halifax? Another historian asks, what if the rulers of the Ming Dynasty had not decided to end naval exploration in the 15th century and Chinese explorers, not Europeans, had come upon the, quote, New World? And what we might ask on this day, if those European explorers had come not as conquerors, but as traders, merchants, people of goodwill, wishing to learn about, not domineer and oppress, the cultures they found. We may wonder, so what's the point of asking these questions? After all, none of these things did happen, so why imagine they might have? I think the point for us to remember is that the past was not preordained. History, says Callie, is not the revelation of some grand scheme. Instead, it is the sum of millions of human decisions. He goes on to say that, in fact, the only fixed rule of history is that there are no rules. But that's not quite true, because we know there are rules that govern the natural world, rules that we don't make, such as gravity, birth, and death, those very rules to which we are very much tethered by natural law. But still, that view of life where we look in either direction, future or past, and say, it could have been, or it could be, oh so different, is a critical view to take, is it not? Scientist Robert Hasson says that life is shaped by two competing powers, the power of emergence and the power of entropy, and that on a human scale, most people use their power to foster emergence. Most people cast their lot on the side of creativity, doing good things, such as building cities, creating art, and using their energies in some way for the good, even for the well-being of others. I love this interpretation of civilization by the late philosopher Will Durant, who says that civilization is a stream with banks. That stream, he says, is sometimes filled with blood from people killing and stealing and shouting and doing things that generally get recorded in history. And certainly, that was the history that I learned in school, dates of battles and wars, defeats and conquests. Who wasn't taught what happened in 1492? There was almost nothing about the social history of what Durant calls life on the banks, real life that goes unnoticed as people build homes and make love and raise children, sing songs, write poetry, and even whittle little statues. But he's right. The real story of civilization is a story of what happens on the banks. It's not the story of Christopher Columbus as much as it is the story of that immigrant family stopping to share their tamale. I hope that we're not naive in wanting to believe that religious community helps fortify the good on the banks kind of moments. Because don't we come here because we believe that what we do can make a difference? We know how often the river is filled with blood, and at its best, religion calls us to the emergence of mercy and compassion, charity and good-heartedness. All good things. But I also expect my religion to do more than that. I need my religion to ask what-if kinds of questions that help to resist all that would take the goodness from life. A poet once wrote, "The thieves of wonder can enter any heart." And so I need my religion to help thwart the thieves, whatever their guise, because heaven knows they abound. And even in the best of times, life on the banks is not always easy. And maybe what we need most of all to prevent the wonder of life being stolen away is not so much the intelligence of Einstein, though certainly a little of that wouldn't hurt, but souls that enable us to acquire his animating ethical virtue of empathy. How we need the virtue of empathy. We need it because there is a natural law of entropy at work that leads to the pouring of blood into rivers. And we need it to resist with all the tenderness, love, generosity, and mercy humanity can provide. Several years ago, I had the very good fortune of being on vacation in Paris. And although I didn't go to church that Sunday morning, I did go to an organ concert that afternoon at the oldest church in the city, Saint-Germain-des-Prés. It was a free concert, and the 1,500-year-old stone church was almost full. There is nothing in that cathedral to absorb sound, no rugs, no drapes, nary a cushion in sight, so the music reverberated throughout the cathedral. It was an all Bach program, and it was glorious. And there I was, in this magnificent cathedral, with the organ pealing out strains of music as beautiful as any music ever written on all of the banks of all the rivers. I was only slightly aware while sitting there that other people were coming in, and they were lighting candles at the feet of the statues that lined both sides of the nave. At one point, I noticed a man walk over to the St. Nicholas statue, the patron saint of children, and he got down on his knees on that hard stone floor. And bowing his head, he put one hand up, just touching the statue's robe, and he prayed in that same position for a very long time. Was it his child, I wondered, and how bad was it? Those few minutes in the church that afternoon said it all for me, summed it all up. We are blessed, and we are cursed in this achingly beautiful and despairingly tragic, tethered world of ours. So let us give praise for the blessings, for sunshine and raindrops, for Bach, and for those who play his music so beautifully, for love, for what-if questions that bring new beginnings and new possibilities, and for all the cherished dependencies of all of our lives. So may it be. Amen.